Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is William Blair. I'm a High Court judge. I sit in the Commercial Court, and for quite a number of years now, I've had an interest in Islamic finance. This lecture, of course, has become a well-known lecture in London on the subject, and it's a great pleasure to be here tonight at the LSE, where, in fact, I'm a visiting professor and so have that connection as well. We have a very distinguished speaker tonight, Mr. Jazim Ahmed, and I'd like, if I may, just to begin by telling you a little bit about him. You will probably know most of this, but I think it's worth just perhaps giving a little bit of context to the remarks that he's going to be making. You probably know that the premier standard-setting body, so far as financial regulation is concerned and Islamic finance is concerned, is the Islamic Financial Services Board. And Mr. Ahmed is Secretary General of the IFSB and became Secretary General on the 1st of May 2011. He has a long experience in the financial sector. He, in particular, served as the Director of Financial Sector, Public Management and Trade of the Southeast Asia Department of the Asian Development Bank, which many of you will be very familiar with. And in that capacity was responsible for managing the ADB's lending technical assistance and capacity building operations in Southeast Asia. Perhaps it's worth noting particularly that Mr. Ahmed led the ADB response to the global financial crisis in Southeast Asia through the design of a number of macroeconomic and financial sector stabilization reform programs, and perhaps there'll be a chance to ask some questions about that afterwards. He indeed now is a member of the consultative group of the Basel Committee for Bank Supervision and sits on the consultative advisory group of the International Auditing and Assurance Standards Board. He is a member of the Governing Council of the International Center for Education in Islamic Finance, is the co-editor of a book on Islamic finance, and he has a BA in economics from the University of Sussex here in England, and also an MA and MPhil from Yale. He is right at the center of everything that's happening in Islamic finance, and it's my great pleasure to ask him to speak.
Thank you very much, Justice Blair, and good evening to everyone. I have a somewhat demanding set of slides, but I'll try and skip over some of them to shorten the presentation. Let me begin by thanking the organizers for this opportunity to speak, and to Justice Blair for the introduction, and also to Dr. Nazim Ali for persuading me to come here. Now, Islamic finance is, in fact, still relatively small in the world compared to global financial system. But it's of sufficiently wide scope that it will be impossible for me or for anyone really to describe all of it in one short lecture. So I'm going to focus really on a subset of issues that are related, I hope, to this very provocative title, Islamic Finance Standardization. Is it a mirage? And I've accepted the title without trying to change it. But one idea that comes to my mind for the next talk perhaps might be one standard to rule them, one standard to bind them all, perhaps. That's probably the thinking behind, in fact, it is the thinking behind many standard setters, whether at the Basel Committee or elsewhere. And before I start, let me just say a few introductory words about how we view standards. And from my perspective, the title of a very famous article by Anantad Mati and Paul Fleidra, who are who are professors at Stanford, says it all. Forcing firms to talk. That's really the purpose of standards and the purpose of regulation. And regulatory bodies like Bank of England require standards and guiding principles to help them design the regulatory framework that will force firms to talk. And that's necessary from a public interest perspective because of the fiduciary responsibility that the regulator has to protect consumers, to protect investors, and for financial stability. And that phrase actually is very useful because from the perspective that a bank or any financial institution will typically also have cross-border subsidiaries. It will want to raise finance abroad, it will want to invest abroad, it will want to distribute products abroad. So you really need to have a language of standards which is mutually intelligible, which is understood across borders. And so from that perspective, there is a strong argument to be made for a single set of standards, certainly for the financial sector. And I would go further to say that there's an argument to be made for the adoption within every jurisdiction of that single set of standards and enforcement. So in principle, I think that would be the ideal. In practice, of course, there are a lot of impediments to achieving that ideal state of the world. And in particular, in Islamic finance, we have a number of aspects to it which make it very difficult to say that the standards that we issue from the IFSB must be adopted, and they must be enforced. And those difficulties are in relation to the capacity or at the institutional level, at the level of the regulator, to adopt standards and to enforce them. And that is really a reflection of the fact that our membership of countries has great diversity in terms of its market development, institutional development, economic development. And many of them are not in a position to enforce their standards as effectively as we'd wish. Now, let me now start with the presentation. Four aspects I'm going to touch on briefly, I hope. I'll give you some time to answer questions. I'll probably, do you want to give me just an indicator, 7:10? Slide, stop around there. Okay, good. Growth and transformation of Islamic finance. It's a relatively recent revival of the industry that we are looking at, 50 years. Although the industry itself goes back, or Islamic finance goes back, centuries, but its revival is very recent. And having described the growth of the industry, which is quite remarkable, especially in the last 10 years, and especially in the aftermath of the global crisis, which is most remarkable, I will then describe how the work that we do at the IFSB has responded to the crisis and in responded to the specific needs of the Islamic financial industry. And I'm going to say I'm going to accept this idea that if you have standards, they have to be adopted. So I'm going to give you a sense of what progress is being made in the adoption of standards. And that's very mixed, as you will see, very mixed. And then finally, if I have some time, I will share with you some thoughts on how we might take this forward. Okay. So this has nothing to do with growth. It's just a starter. This is really the core assumptions, values, principles that underlies Islamic finance. And it's important to start from here because you will see many things here that you believe in, that you think is important, which all of us think are important in our daily lives. Whether we work in Islamic finance or in conventional finance, but there is here a fundamental disjunction between Islamic finance and conventional finance. And that disjunction really is best stated by Lionel Robbins of the LSE in his 1935 paper, when he says that really there is no entanglement between economics and finance, economics and ethics. There isn't. And the most logical way to view the two is in juxtaposition. So that's a very powerful statement, and it's a statement that's popular amongst economists, even today. Just the other day, Paul Krugman said, that economics is not a morality play. True, it's not. But it's fundamentally different from the proposition that Islamic finance begins from, which is the idea that ethics and finance are inextricably linked. Form and substance is one aspect of it. They're inextricably linked, and you have to look at the consequences of what you do. And now, Amartya Sen, another LSE man, at some stage, has drawn a distinction between what he says is a duty-based notion of ethics in finance and a consequentialist-based notion of ethics. And the duty-based notion, which is what conventional finance essentially adopts, says you have a duty to your shareholder and to no one else. The consequences of what you do to maximize shareholder value are irrelevant. That's not the Islamic finance way. Islamic finance is essentially a consequentialist view. It says that duty is important, profit making is important, but you also have to look at the consequences, the wider social consequences. And therefore, finance and ethics are inextricably linked. So there's this, if you like, commonality and disjunction. And I think this is one of the aspects of Islamic finance that has drawn attention to it, especially in the aftermath of a global crisis. I've mentioned growth in the aftermath of the global crisis, and that growth itself suggests that Islamic finance has properties of resilience in it, which have protected it from the crisis. But this is another aspect, and it's an important aspect to bear in mind. 50 years, really, since Islamic finance was revived in the 60s and 70s. It has grown since then. It has been transformed since then. It is now an industry that spans banking, investment banking, insurance, the CAFO. Insurance in Islamic finance begins only in around the 80s, and there are some fundamental issues in grappling with questions of uncertainty and risk sharing, which had to be overcome before we could develop insurance, the CAFO. At the bottom of the diagram, you'll see a number of institutions emerging. 1975, a multilateral development bank, Islamic Development Bank. 1990, IOFI, which is the accounting board for Islamic finance. My own institution, which began in 2002, and then there are some others there which are more recent. The final institution, 2010, is an institution that was set up to address a particular aspect of Islamic finance, which is the absence of liquid financial instruments and liquid financial markets. Islamic banks are highly liquid. They are flush with cash. And their flush with cash puts them at a disadvantage relative to conventional banks. And they're flush with cash because of the underdeveloped state of financial markets, Islamic financial markets, and Islamic financial instruments. So that institution is designed to issue the kind of securities, sukuk, short-term securities, that can help to meet this particular constraint. Okay, so the growth is in the last few years, 2008 to 2014, for banking sector is remarkable, about 16-17% per annum. Now, I think it's worthwhile just to step back a little and remember that between the period 1990 and 2007, global financial assets were growing at about 8 or 9% per annum. Then the crisis occurs in 2007, and global financial assets growth rate drops from 9 to about 2% or 1.5%. Islamic finance, however, really takes off just before the crisis. It's sustained since then. 16% per annum is quite phenomenal. I don't know how long it'll last, but that's the essential experience of Islamic finance. The Islamic banking sector has outperformed all other financial sectors. On the right-hand side is the sukuk. And this is the aggregate stock of sukuk outstanding. And what it essentially says is that since the crisis years, there is a rapid increase in the issuance of sukuk. Sukuk is a kind of securitized product. It gives you ownership rights of an underlying asset. Much of the sukuk there is for a really remarkable reason. It's for financing of infrastructure. That's astonishing. Because in the aftermath of the crisis, new infrastructure projects through bond financing essentially collapse. There's no new infrastructure financing taking place. But there is an Islamic finance, again, very remarkable. And you're seeing another very interesting development, which you'll see is here. Where are the sukuk being issued? It used to be only in Malaysia, or primarily in Malaysia, which has the most advanced regulatory and other capabilities. But now we're seeing the countries in the GCC, Middle East, also issuing sukuk again for infrastructure, another major development. The CAFOL is a very, very small part of Islamic finance, as you can see right there. The measurement of the size is by the volume of contributions, you know, it's just a $25 billion. It's a very small amount. It is negligible, but a profoundly important sector for future development, for a number of reasons. One reason is that insurance is the product that ordinary people need. Whether you're living in rural communities and agricultural community, you worry most about what will happen to your family if crops are affected, if your animals are affected, if the breadwinner suffers an injury. So insurance is profoundly important for ordinary people. But and insurance is an area where, in rural areas, in rural areas, you'll find vast numbers of Muslims will refuse to participate in the conventional instrument. So this is an impediment towards financial inclusion in the wider world, at least in the world of Muslims. And it's an area where we are seeing a lot more interest now by multilateral development banks, but it's also an area of great potential. And the other thing to bear in mind is, in the conventional world, insurance is where the liquidity comes from. And so one of the reasons perhaps why we have problems with liquidity in Islamic finance is the underdeveloped state of the insurance market. Now, the rapid growth sustained for quite a few years has led to the emergence of Islamic finance sectors that are, I won't say they're huge, but they're too large to ignore. If you're a central banker, you should not be sleeping quietly at night in these countries. And I've drawn a line at 15% of your financial sector assets. There are about 10 countries. Iran and Sudan, everything is by definition Islamic. It has to be Sharia compliant. In other countries, that's not the case. And as you can see, the countries where the assets are, where financial sectors are quite large in terms of Islamic finance, are the Middle East. But then there's also Malaysia. Bangladesh is a surprise. I'm from Bangladesh. Quite a surprise to see how big it is, the banking sector in particular. Now, and this is a result of the sustained growth. Right? Because of the growth, we can no longer say that we don't really have to worry too much about the sector because it's too small to affect stability. We now have to worry about it in the domestic context. And my colleagues at the IMF are worrying about it now in a global context to see if they need to understand it better. Now, one of the things I want to stress here is that some of the smallest countries are, in fact, countries of profound potential importance. And what I've said is that there are some very deep-seated reforms taking place in some of these countries. And there are countries like Indonesia and Turkey, which don't really figure high in terms of the assets, but in which growth is very fast. And in each of these countries, what's happening is that the governments are preparing a legal framework that will allow them to fund their public expenditures from Islamic finance. And you're all familiar with public expenditure programs. Public expenditure program usually involves government assurances of sovereign securities to fund government expenditures. So in many of these countries, but not all, but specifically, especially in those small countries, countries with small sectors, Turkey, Indonesia, there is now a comprehensive effort in place to develop an alternative stream of government financing through the issuance of sukuk for financing government expenditures, and then to develop a framework which we find in Malaysia, which is for the... And Malaysia is a country where the government sukuk issuances have helped to develop a benchmark for corporate sukuk issuances and have been instrumental in the development of capital markets. That's how capital markets in the modern world get developed. The government starts issuing large volumes of securities. Those securities provide a benchmark for yields for the corporate sector. Corporate sector now has the ability to move forward. And those government securities also act to help private sector banks to manage their liquidity. So these instruments are, and essentially what these countries are doing are they are replicating through Islamic finance what they've done in the conventional side. Okay. So these also are aspects of the growth phenomenon in Islamic finance, and this shows you that on this axis, this is the size of the banks of these particular banks in relation to the total domestic banking assets. And here on this axis, it's in relation to how big they are. And as you can see, we have now banks which are not big by in relation to JP Morgan, but they're big enough in their own country. D-SIBs, we call them D-SIBs, domestically, you know. So Bangladesh sticks out again. Islami Bank of Bangladesh is a bank which is massive by Bangladeshi standards. So these are modern problems. You start worrying about banks becoming large, and these are the kind of problems that you want to have at some stage. I've mentioned Sukuk, and I want to just come back to it because this is really the leading edge of Islamic finance in many ways. And it's attracted enormous attention for a number of reasons. I've mentioned one reason already. It's a source of, it's an instrument for financing infrastructure. But it's also an instrument for funding capital for banks. It's also an instrument on the asset side for liquidity management. So that's a work in progress, and I'd be the first one to say that in terms of liquidity management, there aren't enough sukuk assurances taking place. And typically what you would want for the liquidity management side is you would want a government or central bank to be issuing short-term government paper, as you do in this country. And that short-term government paper is the paper that is used by banks to manage their short-term liquidity. Now, Sukuk is now being expanded to look at social issues and climate change issues. That's a new development. And one of the most interesting developments is the IFIM Sukuk, which was managed by the World Bank. IFIM is the international financing facility for immunizations. And they have issued a Sukuk, which raised $500 million for immunization. And Sukuk is also offering a potential bridge between two groups of people. These are people who are focused on social issues, on climate change issues in all over the world, but principally in the United States and in Japan, possibly Europe, who in fact don't have enough instruments that meet their needs. And these people are looking at the potential of Islamic finance, which is using a criteria of social relevance, of ethical relevance. And so what we are hoping for, and what I think our colleagues in the World Bank and others are looking at, is the structuring of social and green sukuk, which would bring these two groups together. A bridge between conventional investors and Islamic finance on the other side. But Islam, so those are all the good things that are happening. The difficult agendas are in fact fundamental, basic. And they go back to what I said earlier about the very diverse situation in terms of institutional and other development. Legal frameworks, very underdeveloped. Very few countries have well-developed legal frameworks. Of course, Malaysia is completely the other end. It has a very advanced legal framework. It has a very explicit, strong enforcement mechanisms, high degree of certainty in the legal framework. But that's not the case in general. In many countries, the legal frameworks are extremely abbreviated. There are some countries, 11 in this survey, which don't have any legal basis at all for Islamic finance. Central bank is passing decrees. Essentially, it's acting on its own authority. In other countries, however, I think you will find that the legal framework is being developed, but it takes a long time. It's a political process. All legal frameworks are not easy to develop, especially when it comes to issues that are new, like Islamic finance. But more broadly, there's a whole range of issues that remain unfinished business. The legal framework falls under what I'd call the enabling framework, tax and regulatory issues, Sharia governance, liquidity risk management structure, which I've already mentioned. This is extremely underdeveloped. Markets are underdeveloped. There aren't enough Sharia scholars. The regulatory capabilities are limited. And they're limited for two reasons. In some cases, because this is a new industry. But in other cases, and more broadly, because the countries themselves are at a relatively underdeveloped state of development. Now, these are very important issues because they are what, for standard setters, whether it's Basel Committee or us or the IFSB, these are preconditions. When we issue standards, every standard we will say, these are the preconditions, and our preconditions will mention all of these issues. You need all of these issues in place to have an effective enforcement adoption and enforcement of those standards. So this is not by any means something that we can simply say that will get addressed in time. It will get addressed in time, but it has a profound impact on the adoption and enforcement of standards. And this is where the major difference is between the IFSB's members and the members of the Financial Stability Board, the G20 group. The G20 group is essentially a group of countries, of advanced countries, advanced market development, advanced capabilities. For them, these are all business already done. For us, this is where we are struggling. And so this is a major challenge at the level of each jurisdiction and globally for Islamic finance. How do we overcome this? And in my view, it essentially starts here, sequencing. You have to ask, what is it that we need to do first? Because you have to do everything, but which do you do first? And I find that often what happens is that a regulator or a government will say, we want an Islamic bank, let's issue the license. They issue the license, and they have forgotten a couple of things. They have forgotten that that bank will need liquidity management instruments. They have forgotten also that their regulator has to understand what Islamic finance is. And I've gone to countries where I've had to say to the central bank that if your staff don't know what this bank is facing, you've issued two or three licenses already, and you are not prepared as a government to issue sovereign sukuks, then I think you should withdraw your license. So I think sequencing is absolutely critical to addressing these issues. And I always tell people, you start by a crash course inside your government, inside your central bank, to understand what it is. It's a very effective way of speaking to regulators once they've issued the license. But it's better that they don't issue the license until they've understood. Okay. Let me now go to what the standard setting actually involves. And I'd like to just very briefly run you through the conventional world, because we are in fact part of a global community at the IFSB and my counterparts in Islamic finance. And in that global community, we look to the work of the Basel Committee for Bank Supervision, International Association of Insurance Supervisors. The FSB is the Financial Stability Board, and IOSCO is the International Organization of Securities Commissions. They are the standard setters for the conventional banking, capital markets, and insurance sectors. We work very closely with them. I'll explain exactly how we work with them. And we look at how they work. And if you look at how they work, you'll get a sense of how we work. So I'll just look at the Basel Committee, primary standard setter for banks. And then on the right-hand side, you'll see the strategy, monitoring the adoption of the Basel standards, supporting implementation, fostering timely, consistent, effective implementation. Those are our goals, but we are some way off from achieving them in the same way that the Basel Committee has. Now, I'm going to mention Financial Stability Institute, which is one of the institutions that are co-located in Basel, in Switzerland, because they do the work that supports Basel, surveys of implementation, capacity building. We do all of that in one small institution in Kuala Lumpur. Islamic finance standardization. It's not really all that different in conceptual terms from the conventional finance. The only thing fundamental difference, of course, is that we have the Sharia. And Islamic finance has to be consistent with the Sharia. And there are multiple issues of complexity involving whether the Sharia is in fact incorporated into your national law or not. But I'm not going to address that. What I'm going to look at rather is something else, which is to say that when we talk about financial sector, we're talking about product conduct regulation, we're also talking about stability issues. The purpose of standards is really to provide transparency, certainty, confidence. And standards have to be reflected in your legal frameworks. At some point, in the European Union, they say one standard for 33 systems. Anytime the European Union passes a standard, it has to be reflected in the legal framework. The European Union is a very advanced state of integration. They are focused on harmonized legal frameworks, harmonized standards, in a way that nobody else in the world is. But there are sectors where harmonization is not possible. So they have harmonized goals plus mutual recognition, where you can't harmonize everything, you recognize that other country standards are good enough. Now, very few countries would say that they want to have identical legal frameworks. Very few countries. Would you, if you went to the United States and said you should have identical legal framework harmonized with the United Kingdom, that would probably cause some problems. But it's quite often the case you will say we need to have harmonized single set of Sharia standards. Very difficult. There are distinct schools of thought in Sharia. And it's very hard to eradicate those differences, especially when, for Muslims, differences are to be, differences come from the Quran, from God himself. God said, we made you different. So you have to accept differences. But in practice, what we are seeing is that the difficulties are less to do with the differences. Difficulties are more to do with how the Sharia fits into the legal, national legal framework. Especially in jurisdictions in the Middle East where you have civil codes adopted from the Ottomans, who adopted from Napoleon, from the French. And you have constitutions, and you have a recognition that the source of law will be both the civil code, which is secular, plus the constitution, plus Sharia in some degree. That's where the uncertainty comes. But in practice, in the field of Islamic finance, I think what we're seeing that we are seeing people adopt approaches which meet their customers' needs. So I don't think that Sharia standards need to be exactly the same everywhere. There are going to be differences. But we are seeing a dissemination of views and viewpoints which is leading to some degree of convergence. This is a work in progress. And one thing to remember in mind is that unlike common law, Sharia looks like common law. It looks like judges are making decisions. Of course they are. But in common law, you have this concept of binding precedent, stare decisis. That binding precedent is not really there in Islamic finance, but it might emerge. It will emerge if Sharia decisions are disseminated widely enough. People will recognize commonalities of decision making. So for global standards, the two big institutions, or the two main institutions, because they're both small, are IFSB and OFI. OFI focuses on accounting and Sharia issues. We at the IFSB, we don't have any opinions, generally, on what is Sharia compliant. We leave that to the national jurisdiction. We have a Sharia advisory board which tells us, okay, what you've done is acceptable. But OFI will actually opine on Sharia issues. Is this product a Sharia-approved product? We won't, but they will. That's their job. Now, I won't say anything more about this, except that the preconditions I mentioned are fundamental to both Basel and to us, and this continues to be a major problem for us. Now, IFSB standards, we issue standards for capital adequacy, for Sukuk issuances, for liquidity management. We have essentially three principles. First of all, the standards have to be benchmarked against standards that already exist. Basel Committee, IOSCO, and others. But those standards are not always sufficient for us because they don't address the specific risks that are attached to Sharia-compliant products. And so that's where we provide our additionality. These standards are especially important because of the rapid growth of the industry. We need a consistent framework to guide that rapid growth, to guide the regulation and supervision of that growth. So that's where that principle comes into place. And the third principle is that because it's becoming larger, it's now important for Islamic finance to be integrated into the global surveillance system. Surveillance, I don't mean personal surveillance, but surveillance that is carried out by the IMF of global financial stability. And there's a formal framework for that. Every country is evaluated. And now it's time, I feel, and my colleagues in the IMF are beginning to come around to the idea that Islamic finance also has to be integrated into that because it's too big now. It's still small, but too big to ignore. Now, in the last, since the crisis, massive body of work has been done. I won't go to all of the details. The central area that we have focused on is the work of the Basel Committee, which is focused on capital and liquidity. And during the crisis, we found that banks, conventional banks, did not have enough high-quality capital to absorb losses. This is where Islamic finance is different. An Islamic bank typically has 95% Tier 1 capital, common equity, which is astonishing. Liquidity management. Crisis was triggered by the drying up of liquidity. So those are the two critical areas. Stress testing. All of these issues have been the focus of our work. And we've responded to it through a series of standards, five standards in the last 3 years, development of new standards, and also looking at such issues as the financial safety net that is needed to underpin the financial sector. By the safety net, I mean things like deposit insurance schemes, lender of last resort, which we saw during the crisis as being fundamental. Lender of last resort was instrumental in preventing the collapse of global financial markets. The Federal Reserve's actions in 2008 and 2009, without them, I think the global financial system would have collapsed. Those are things which we don't yet have in Islamic finance that are Sharia compliant. Those are works in progress, and we're developing proposals and concepts for that. We have five new standards under preparation. I want to mention these two in particular. Core principles for Islamic finance is a response to the Basel Committee, which issues core principles. And the idea is that these core principles will allow central banks like the Bank of England or the Bank of Central Bank of Zambia to have essentially the same approach and understanding as to what is needed for the regulation and supervision of banks in their very different jurisdictions. And in providing this framework of core principles, we are also enabling the people at the IMF to see that this is similar to what the work that they do using Basel principles in their financial surveillance through a program called the Financial Sector Assessment Program, which countries voluntarily have entered into. Here on liquidity risk management, we are responding to the framework which Basel has put in place, which says you must have very high levels of liquidity, 30-day liquidity, one-year liquidity. And we have some problems with that because Basel has very stringent requirements on the kind of assets that you can use for liquidity management. Again, as I mentioned already, that's where there's a huge dearth of those kinds of assets in Islamic finance. So we are, in issuing this guidance note, what we are trying to do is provide a level playing field. And we have one from Basel, some flexibility in the kinds of instruments that we can use to manage the liquidity of Islamic banks in the interim period that is needed for them, for jurisdictions in which they work, to develop those kinds of instruments and markets. So as you can see, a very close relationship between the regulatory framework emerging from the center of the global financial system, if you like, and having an impact in Islamic finance, and us responding back and saying that, wait a minute, what you're proposing here is going to cause us problems, we need more flexibility. So the standards that we are coming out with to manage liquidity, to manage capital, to fund capital, they are Sharia compliance standards. They are focused on the kinds of instruments that would be acceptable in our jurisdiction, but also consistent with the principles laid down by Basel. And so that should, over time, lead to not convergence in practices, but mutual understanding. So the regulator can understand that his Islamic banking system has a certain set of risks and compare them to his conventional banking system and the risks that has. And it should enable the people at the IMF to have a grasp of where the stress is in the global financial system before it gets beyond control. This is just a working group of core principles. I don't think it's important. Implementation is very important. We have a program. We are small, but we have a program on implementation. I'll just take you to the. This is how we conduct implementation. We go to 6 countries every year. We have 3 programs in our headquarters at Kuala Lumpur, and we work with a number of other institutions. And implementation is important for all the reasons I've already mentioned. Your standards have to be adopted. They have to be enforced. So implementation is vital. Now, the real question is, has there been implementation and adoption? And I think I'm not going to go through these. I'm just going to say that yes, there has been considerable progress in the adoption of IFSB standards. It's picking up. It's picking up primarily in those countries where the industry is more than 5% of the domestic financial system. In countries where it's smaller than that, frankly, the central bank has so many other things to do. That's probably the thinking. But this is a very interesting summary of what people are saying are the key difficulties. people are saying that there's a need to strengthen the regulatory and supervisory framework. Lack of personnel, cost of implementation. But these are the two that are the most important, capacity and the legal framework. Those are issues which I flagged at the very beginning. And they require a different approach from us. Essentially, they're telling us that the work that we're doing in implementation is fine, but we need additional assistance. So time frame, implementation is accelerating, at least in Islamic finance. People are saying that 2 years ago they told us that we will be adopting new standards over a five-year framework. Now they're saying within a three-year framework. Demand for technical assistance is increasing. That's beyond our capability. We don't have the capacity. My institution is 26 staff members. And it's really very difficult for us to rise to the occasion unless we have additional resources. I'm just going to, let me just close. I think I've spoken for long enough. I'm just going to close with a little few observations about the IFSB. What is it? It's a little bit different from Basel because Basel is quite small, about 20, 25 regulators, heads of supervisory agencies. That's my board, about 22 regulatory bodies, central banks. But our membership is much larger. Membership is about 184, one-third are regulators, two-thirds are private sector institutions, banks, and mostly Islamic banks. And then we have our small group of multilaterals, the IMF, World Bank, IDB, Asian Development Bank, and so on. We work very closely with our comparators. I sit in the Basel Consultative Group. Justice Blair has mentioned that we work closely with the Insurance Supervisors Association. We're working with ISCO now. So this, I use this slide just to give you a sense that, in fact, the work of Islamic finance is not in isolation to the work of the global community. Sometimes it might seem like that. And in fact, just the other day, someone was telling me that Islamic finance is a niche industry. I think what I would like to leave you with the thought is that it's no longer just a niche industry. It's certainly a niche industry in some countries, but it's now sufficiently large that you have to start worrying. We have to worry in this modern age about stability. And Islamic finance has been very stable during this crisis. Part of that is because of conduct, the ethical standards I mentioned. Those ethical standards put a high premium on prudence, on not being imprudent, on avoiding excessive uncertainty. And so part of the reason why the Islamic banking system was stable during the crisis was that it didn't have exposure to the toxic assets that triggered the global crisis. Because those toxic assets, those securitized mortgages in the United States, were just incomprehensible to the Sharia advisory boards of Islamic banks. They were incomprehensible, and they also worried them very deeply. Too many layers of structure. So conduct is very important. But conduct may not be enough. That's what we worry about. That's what I worry about. Conduct may not be enough when you don't have strong legal and regulatory frameworks, or sufficiently strong legal and regulatory frameworks. On the other hand, the Islamic banks are very well capitalized. That protects them, gives them additional buffers of absorption, of loss absorption capabilities. So the final thing I'll leave you with is really that I think inherently there are some strong aspects to Islamic finance that distinguish it from conventional finance and make it more resilient. But if the global economy goes into a tailspin, then no one can survive that. That affects everyone, and we've seen that happen to Islamic finance also. The first round of the crisis did not affect Islamic finance, but the second round, 2008 and 9, when the global economy tanked, international trade tanked, then all of the economies of the world also contracted. And profitability fell in Islamic finance also. But profitability has come back. I don't know for how long, but so it's a work in progress. Let me stop there. Thank you very much. Any questions, I'll be happy to answer, provided they're not too technical.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Rama, for a really excellent lecture and a great tour d'horizon. Really putting the subject into its international setting in the financial world. Can I just make one small point myself before inviting questions and comments? Your first slide, or second slide, I forget now, was on this question of ethical values. There's a great deal of interest now in the conventional financial field on this point. I chaired a meeting at the Bank of England in January. We had a very big turnout on this subject of ethics in finance, and I think it's one of the strengths of Islamic finance, actually, and where there's a room for a good interchange. So that's from me, and I'd like to invite questions or observations. There are mics. It would be appreciated if you'd just briefly say who you are before speaking, and possibly keep it relatively short, so we've got time to get the answers as well. And who'd like to begin? Yes.
Hi, Justine.
Next. We'll have you next.
Okay. Thank you very much. My name is Michael Gassner. I run a website also on Islamic Finance, islamicfinance.de. Many people know that already. And what I always wanted to know about regulation, we have a lot to do, I assume, with the Basel people in Basel, of course, and Bank of International Settlement and FSI and all you mentioned them. How much do they think about equity finance at this stake to promote this? Because capital rate under Basel II was up to 200-400%,
yes.
Which means that equity finance for me as a banker is stupid to do, because I cannot earn so much that the return on equity makes any sense afterwards. So we only give debt for that reason, in my opinion. And is there any discussion among the conventional regulators, any understanding that they promote debt instead of balance and equilibrium? Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure.
I'm going to take that's an excellent question. Thank you. I'm going to take another question and then ask Mr. Ahmed to answer them both. Yes, if you could introduce yourself.
Okay, hi. Bashir Omar, UAL Finance Master Student. And also, as a member who's currently working in financial markets, the question I'd like to ask yourself is... there was a recent paper published by the UK government. It's the Commonwealth and Foreign Office, which talked about the forecasted growth of the Islamic finance industry in 2015, predicted to be up to $2 trillion. So the question really is from an IFSB perspective, how can Islamic banks venture into governments which are established, as you've explained, such as the UK, which have high legal frameworks. Is that an opportunity?
Thank you.
Okay, I think on the equity question, the risk weighting for equity, our approach is very similar. Banks are very reluctant to participate in that kind of venture. But what we do is we provide flexibility so that it depends. You can have the risk weighting can fall from 400% to 70% if needed, depending on the judgment of the regulator on the entity and how well managed the entity is. Because in equity, the issue really is asymmetric information. That's why the risks are higher and the risk weighting is higher. So our approach is not that different from Basel. Except that we would provide a greater level of flexibility, because we do want to see greater profit and loss sharing kind of contracts emerge. The other issue, I think, I should have mentioned, of course, the tremendous work that is being done in the United Kingdom by successive governments and coming to fruition in this government with the issuance of that landmark Sukuk last year. So I think that's very encouraging. That reflects a high-level policy decision which is essential for Islamic finance to flourish in a safe way. You need the policymaker to take a strong public policy stance. And that gives me great encouragement in the sense that I think that means that the policymaker and the regulator will be much more accommodating or accommodative to the flourishing of the broad industry, and not just the banking sector. For example, the government has floated a paper, I don't know what status is now, on student financing, which will involve a takaful-type risk-sharing concept. So I think we are going to see, I think it's quite likely, we're going to see in the UK more and more of these innovations taking place as confidence grows that the policymaker and the regulator are stepping forward. The regulator, the Bank of England, has a note on its website on how it is going to provide liquid facilities for Islamic banks in the interim. I've mentioned the issues only in passing, but there is a country like the UK, which may not have an adequate supply of Sharia-compliant liquid instruments, has other options. And those are called alternative liquidity arrangements, in which the central bank provides lines of credit, if you like, lines of financing. So, again, very encouraging to see that kind of thing. So at the moment, I think you have 5 or 6 banks which are essentially domestic banks, but that could grow. You might see cross-border banking operations take place. And again, the point I would want to stress again and again is in the UK, the wake-up, if you like, or the take-up by the public policymaker is really the essential precondition, in my view, for addressing all of the challenges that any jurisdiction faces. And markets are fine. Market-led development is fine, but Islamic finance is difficult. You need the government to step in and make sure the enabling environment is there.
Just on liquidity, before asking for further questions, your successor, I think, is heading the Islamic liquidity.
Yeah, Professor, my predecessor.
Predecessor.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I mentioned that institution right up front, the Islamic International Liquidity Management Corporation, and in fact, I sat on the task force that established it. So it's a very Southeast Asian view of the world. You have national policies for developing markets and liquid instruments, but then you get together and you establish an international mechanism. And in Southeast Asia, we have an ASEAN bond market initiative, which is very similar. And what this institution is doing is not supplanting the role of the domestic policymaker, but supporting it by issuing high-quality securities that central banks like the Malaysian Central Bank, Bank Negara Malaysia, have rated as HQLA. HQLA is the formal requirement under Basel, high-quality liquid assets, and the formal requirements are quite difficult. This institution has now, I think, had 6 or 7 issuances, which is a good start because it had to also establish a primary dealer network, international primary dealer network, which is tremendously demanding. It's tough enough to develop a primary dealership within your jurisdiction, but to develop one that is cross-border is even more difficult. So I don't think that any one institution can solve all the problems, but the idea is that it's not burdened with solving all of the liquidity management issues. It's rather that it will, through an issuance program, provide some degree of resolution of this difficulty in finding high-quality liquid assets. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Other questions, please? Yes, sir.
Iqbal, sorry, Jasim, thank you very much for that presentation. We noticed that in the conventional markets after the crisis, there has been an increased issuance of what we call contingent capital, which clearly brings in an element of equity participation in the event of certain credit events occurring. I don't know if there is some scope for developing that in the Islamic financial markets to solve the liquidity issues. Has IFSB done anything on that?
Well, this particular issue is principally related to the liability side, the funding side. So on the funding side, What Basil has done is said that, look, let's have high quality capital, but let's also have capital which starts off as debt. When the bank is what we call a going concern, it's alive. But when the bank pops it and becomes a gone concern, then this capital gets bailed in. It becomes equity-like. And the idea is that it helps, it gives additional capital, additional buffer in the case of a shock to the bank or to the financial system. Now, for Islamic finance, we have issued a standard called the Revised Capital Adequacy Standard, which takes this up, but it is, as you know, a subject that is fraught for us because in Islamic finance, the issue of contingency has to be able to successfully resolve the prohibition or the guidance on complexity and uncertainty. And this is the issue on which we had the most protracted discussions with our Sharia Advisory Board. So you will see on our website the standard in which we lay out the requirements for the kind of structure that we think can provide this kind of funding. And what we require is that you specify up front the threshold or the triggers that will lead to, that will lead from one state of the world to the other state of the world. On the other hand, we also have the flexibility to jurisdictions. So there are jurisdictions which are comfortable with the Basel approach, and other jurisdictions which will be much more stringent. Very tough issue. On the liquidity side, again, the structure we are, sorry, liquidity side, on the asset side, we are proposing are very similar in terms of Musharaka, Mudaraba, Sukuk. There's a great deal of flexibility that we and Basel provide. So, for example, Basel will say that, your securities must meet these stress conditions. But at the end of the day, it's up to you as a regulator to decide whether they do. And to just to give you an example, in Malaysia, the central bank has decided that IILM, the institution that Justice Blair just recently mentioned, is highly rated paper. It's HQLA. Not every country will decide that. Conversely, in the United States, the Federal Reserve, for example, has stepped in and said that the securities issued by the GSEs, government-sponsored entities, the Fannie Mae's, the Freddie Mac's. It could have said that these are level one assets, highly HQLA level one, but it said no. Because that would mean giving it the full faith and confidence of the United States, and they didn't want to do that. So they said no, this is HQLA, but it's level two, level 2A. So flexibility is there, but the underlying absence of high quality liquid asset is still one that affects Islamic finance.
What about using some kind of contingent capital for funding the Qazul Hasan requirement of the capital?
That takes us into some really technical issues, and the kafal itself is a very complex structure.
There's a question here. Thank you.
And I'm a PhD candidate from the University of Reading. I've got actually two questions. The first one, which is you mentioned two global standards. One is IFSB, another one IOFI,
yeah.
And my question is that, is there any clash between these two standards or not? And do you think it will be...
So the first question is clash.
Yes, the clash between...
Clash of the titans or clash of the whatever, yeah.
And the second question is about the Sharia board. And would you please more explain about how does the Sharia board work in IFSB? Because you mentioned...
Yeah. We have a board, yes.
So you made the rules and send it to the Sharia board and they accept it, or there is another procedure?
Good.
Thank you.
I think IFSB, IOFI are not clashing institutions. They're complementary institutions. And the way to view it is that the work that we do is guiding the regulations of central banks. Yep. It's the prudential regulation supervision. We do look at transparency and disclosure issues, but not perhaps in the level of granularity or detail that OFI does. So OFI is an accounting and audit body. It's also a Sharia compliance body, which is something that we are not. We don't issue Sharia fatwas. OFI will. So it's complementary in my view. There is no clash. I don't know of any clash. I get on very well with my colleague Hamid Mehra, who's the Secretary General of IFSB. Now, there's also the complementarity comes in many different ways. I don't mean complementary in a sort of right angle to each other, you know, that one doesn't affect the other. I think they are complementary. So, for example, IOFI was established in 1990, I believe. IOFI Financial Accounting Standard number 6 has got a lot of guidance on for Islamic banks on transparency and disclosure in relation to the deposit accounts that are held in Islamic banks. And those are very peculiar in relation to conventional banks, because in addition to the pure checking account, you have the deposit account, which is called the profit-sharing investment account. And in those investment accounts, IOFI has provided some extremely important guidance on what the bank has to do to make it clear on how it is remunerating those, or make those accounts, or how it is making those accounts absorb losses. Because in principle, those accounts have to both absorb losses as well as benefit from profit. Now, we ourselves have also a number of standards that address precisely this issue, but we've taken them up at a later stage. Then IOFI has standards which are extremely important for in relation to consumer protection issues, transparency and disclosure. We will take them up in due course from the perspective of the banking sector. So I think there is no clash at all. Now, the second issue, how does the Sharia Advisory Board operate? Essentially, what a Sharia Advisory Board does is it provides an additional layer of internal audit. And although practices differ, in principle, the Sharia Advisory Board is reviewing and reviewing every single project, every single product for Sharia compliance. It's the kind of work that is now being proposed by a number of people for conventional banks, not in terms of Sharia compliance, but in terms of, for example, an entity called the New Products Committee. That's a proposal that has been made. Now, what would a New Products Committee do? It would do something. It would essentially look at the potential impact of a new product in terms of what kind of benefits, costs it might generate, using ethical criteria, using statistical criteria, whatever. So in a sense, that would be, in my mind, some of the substance of the Sharia Advisory Board without the form. So think of it as an internal audit, and at the end of the year, the Sharia Advisory Board also provides a certification that the work of the institution has conformed to the Sharia. That's very important.
Thank you very much. Yes, a question there.
Hi, my name is Noura, and I'm a PhD student from the School of Oriental and African Studies, University of London. My first question is, since the regulator, they really want to create a level playing field for Islamic banks, alongside with the conventional banks, do you think that the Islamic banks can be treated on a level playing field when they are actually regulated within the conventional regulatory framework? And my second question is, do you think that the principles of IFSB should be compulsory for the financial services? Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
I think both are very important questions. Let me turn to the first one. The first one, let me do the second one first. The second one is really the one about enforcement. When it comes to enforcement, the point I've been trying to make is that it's highly desirable that you have a single consistent framework to guide regulators. So yes, I would like to see our standards adopted, first of all, by the regulator, and then enforced. But I worry that saying that the IFSB standards should be enforced would be impractical in a situation where you have jurisdictions in which the regulator and the banks themselves are quite weak in capabilities, or the regulator is weak. So if I look at the Basel Committee, I see their work involving 20 years, if you like, 25 years or 24 years of cooperation, voluntary cooperation, And then only in the aftermath of the crisis do we have a voluntary commitment to, compulsory implementation of the new framework. So I think over time, something similar might happen for Islamic finance and the IFSB standards, that we issue standards which are we regard as voluntary. We don't force our members to enforce them. It's up to the national regulator to decide when it can enforce them. But I can, 25 years from now, perhaps, the IFSB's membership will say, the standards, these standards will be enforced within a 3-year time period. I think that might happen. Your first question, can you just remind me again about what can the conventional regulator do to make a level playing field between the two? Yeah, that's actually... Yeah, it's often they're not. And the problem is, sometimes they are. So a country like Turkey has a single legal and regulatory framework with small adjustments for Islamic finance. So that's straightforward. But you've got countries where the regulatory framework, reserve requirements are exactly the same for Islamic banks as for conventional banks. So take reserve requirements, for example. Banks have to put whatever they have to put, 10%, 20% of their deposit into reserves, which are remunerated. Okay. So, and the remuneration, of course, is paid in the form of interest. So for an Islamic bank, that's haram. That's not Sharia compliant. And so the Islamic bank would not be able to take that remuneration. And so essentially you have a two-tier system. You have a system of remunerated reserves for one set of banks, conventional, and you have a system of unremunerated reserves for the Islamic bank. So I think that's the kind of issue that needs to be resolved at the first instance, if we are going to provide a level playing field. And sometimes this is just a question of recognition of what the issues are. So I think it can be, you can provide a level playing field. Level playing field typically begins with the tax framework, because many Islamic financial transactions, whether they're within banks or within investment banks or in securities institutions, involve multiple transactions that are part of a single transaction, sale, lease, or sale buyback. So if you tax each of those, then you multiply the cost and Islamic financials becomes non-competitive. So that's where the level playing field begins. And this country, for example, was in fact quite astute in looking at the tax framework right at the very beginning and making sure that the tax recognition was neutral. And then the regulator, of course, also has to look at that neutrality. How do you ensure neutrality? Not easy sometimes.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Hamda. I have a question. What is the current relationship of IFSB with the FRC in the UK? And if any, have the FRC announced new reporting requirements in response to IFSB's proposals?
You have to explain to me what the FRC is.
The FRC is the Financial Reporting Council.
Financial?
Reporting Council.
I see. So this would be a accreditation council, or?
Actually, it collaborates with accounting standard setters.
I see. Okay.
From across countries and the IASB
to
influence
development. Now I get the picture. Yeah. We don't have a formal relationship with the FRC. We have a working relationship with the International Federation of Accountants and the International Auditing and Assurance Standards Boards and related ones. But typically, we would not get involved on granular accounting issues. We leave the accounting framework to our colleagues at IOFI. I mentioned IOFI, the Accounting and Audit Organization for Institutions Offering Islamic Finance. So the answer is we don't have a relationship as of yet. I don't rule it out in the future, but not as yet.
Yes, sir?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a quick one. Do you have a relationship because you mentioned about having people that are trained with the right qualifications? Do you have any relationship with organizations or bodies like CIMA in terms of tailoring Islamic qualification that suits what you do?
No, I'm afraid we don't. We don't have any, we don't work in the qualifications part or capacity building side from that perspective. It's a very important part of any financial system. Accreditation, qualification, certification of qualifications, and so on. But that's not our remit. Our remit is providing the guiding principles that will enable central banks and securities commissions to regulate their sectors. So the capacities that are needed for the regulatees are extremely important, but they fall outside of our remit.
Thank you. Any questions? Can I then, just before closing, because I know we started a little early, I'll ask a question which relates to interest. This is not a technical question in any way, it's more a conceptual one. Now, for about 4 years or so, maybe a little more, we have, at least from the perspective of benchmark rates in the conventional banking system, virtually zero interest rates. In one or two cases, Switzerland, negative interest rates, but perhaps that's rather special. This is completely new so far as we're concerned. The bank rate in this country was 4% almost right through the 19th century and through most of the, quite a lot of the 20th century as well. So to have rates near zero is very, very unusual. Do you think there is any kind of anything that might come as some kind of insight from perhaps the Islamic banking sector or anything that you see as making some kind of connection here, or do you see it as simply a passing phase and nothing of any great significance?
The zero interest rate that we are now seeing in the conventional world are really partly a knock-on effect, I think, of the inflation targeting model used by most Western countries of 2% inflation. Interest rates have been adjusted in the past to maintain that inflation rate. And what no one envisaged was that a massive economic contraction would bring inflation down and interest rates down to these levels. So we are now in a liquidity trap. We are probably now in a prolonged phase of economic downturn, with interest rates stuck at this level for a long time to come, perhaps. I don't think Islamic finance has anything to say, but say about the manner in which conventional finance is now apparently looks like Islamic finance, zero interest rate. But Islamic finance recognizes that the value of a yield, profit yield. So, I mean, an interest rate in an economic, your PhD students, many students here, interest rate is just the marginal product of capital from a general equilibrium perspective. And that's very consistent with an Islamic finance framework, which says that return on capital, return on profit, on investment, that's the rate of return is Sharia compliant. So I think the issue is perhaps less to do with Islamic finance and much more to do with some of the inherent aspects of the conventional financial system which we were not aware of. No one ever imagined that we would have this kind of balance sheet crisis. Now, that is where I think Islamic finance has something to say, yes. The nature of the crisis in the Western world is essentially a balance sheet crisis. And a balance sheet crisis is, to my way of thinking, is deeply embedded. Concern about balance sheet, about debt, is deeply embedded
inside the thinking of Islamic finance. The concern that when you have very high levels of debt, that you bring individuals and societies to collapse. I think that's where the problem is. The lack of recognition by the policymakers in the crisis countries of the nature of the problem, and the inability and unwillingness to come up with measures that would rapidly resolve the balance sheet problem. And that again reflects a big difference between Islamic finance and a significant difference and conventional finance, which is the view that creditor rights are paramount. And I think in Islam the idea is, of course, that debt, you have an obligation to repay your debt, but the person who provides the debt has an obligation to understand also your difficulty. And this is where the legal system and the policy-making system in the crisis countries will have a huge problem. So the United States has failed over a five-year period to come up with a coherent, effective structure for debt restructuring of the household sector. And it has failed because, for reasons which are very hard for Americans to understand, but which are clear if you stand outside, because the policies are essentially being made by the creditors. And so successive attempts to resolve that problem have not been successful. And as a result of that, a generation of people have been wiped out, especially African Americans. So there are a lot of these hidden aspects of, when you're very successful, you sometimes forget about the vulnerabilities that actually existed within your framework. And Governor King, before he retired, I was at a conference with him in Basel, and he said something which I think really struck a chord. And he said that nobody ever reads or bothers about what happens in other countries. And it was true, I probably shouldn't have said all those things, but...
Well, thank you very much indeed, Mr. Ahmed. It was a fascinating evening, and as I said earlier...
Blair, if I could just make an observation. I've just noticed two magazines in front of you, and they are, I believe that there are some very lengthy, non-technical interviews with me inside them.
Well, you've certainly whetted our appetite. So,
In each of them.
Let's just express our really warm thanks to our speaker for a really brilliant evening.